From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, Israeli doctors give some insight into their work with people who continue to live in war-torn Syria.
Plus how partnerships are allowing the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center to learn about the history of its land.
The founder of Express Yourself Milwaukee talks about using the arts to reach kids in a variety of settings, including prison.
Guards whose job it is to hold the line are also smiling and beating along with the drum beat and in there helping us finish set pieces and, art is a way that we can join with each other.
And mystery novelist Patricia Skalka talks about the surprise inspiration for her latest Door County mystery.
I've been coming up here for decades. I've ridden that ferry a zillion times, and it has never occurred to me to use ferry in one of the books. Talk about staring at the obvious and not seeing it.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The civil war in Syria has been ongoing for more than 7 years. Some estimates put the casualties at near 500,000, and the chaos of the war has contributed to the global refugee crisis.
More than 5 million people have fled the country, but there are even more displaced people still living in the war-torn nation, many lacking access to medical care. In response to the crisis, the Israeli Defense Force has enlisted the help of Israeli hospitals located relatively near the Syrian border to care for people impacted by the war.
Dr. Betsheva Sadoch is the deputy chief of the emergency department at Baruch Padeh Medical Center in Poria. And Dr. Erez On is the director general of the hospital. They were in Milwaukee as guests of the Israel Center of Milwaukee Jewish Federation and Partnership Together.
They sat down with Lake Effect producer Joy Powers to talk about their work with Syrian war victims, and they explain why the program has largely been kept a secret.
We kept it low profile for the safety of the programs, for the continuation of the safety of the programs. Basically, the IDF is bringing us Syrians that are in need of medical care. And as one of the hospitals in the north, we give that care to the Syrians. We have a number of programs. We have a program which we talked about in the various medical communities here in the Milwaukee area, is a clinic for chronically ill Syrian children. And we're able to give them treatment. These are children with diabetes, with all sorts of ENT, ear, nose, and throat conditions. We give them treatment. We give them medical treatment. We also give them surgical treatments.
So the vast majority of people you're seeing are people who are specifically ill or have been injured.
Yes. These are chronically, we have a number of programs basically inside the hospital. One is throughout the years we've been treating Syrian injured from injuries of war in our in-hospital treatment. Now in 2016, a clinic for chronically ill children was opened with the help of the Israeli Defense Force. These are children that have serious conditions such as diabetes, congenital heart disease, epilepsy, orthopedic conditions, ENT conditions, ear, nose, and throat conditions. And they're brought to us in a clinic that is open from the early hours of the morning till the late hours of the afternoon. And we give them primary care, which is basically life-saving for children that are in war-torn Syria. These are children with diabetes that they have no access to insulin. Children with chronic, enlarged tonsils that suffer from tonsillitis. But in war-torn Syria, tonsillitis can be a life-threatening condition. So we arrange for them also to come back and do tonsillectomies in our hospital.
What are the biggest obstacles in getting patients from Syria to you? I mean, as you mentioned, it's a semi-secretive program, so
right.
It must be difficult even really getting these patients
right.
there.
I'm assuming it's very difficult. This is work that is done by the Israeli Defense Force. They're the ones, they bring us the children, And we're responsible for giving them the medical treatment. And the challenges that they encounter is not something that we're supposed to know anything about because, as you know, Syria and Israel are not considered, we're considered enemy countries. So this is pretty delicate work.
Which is why it remains secretive.
Yeah, until recently it was kept secret.
How are we able to talk about it now? What's changed?
I really don't know. I don't know. These are things we don't know.
Fair enough. What are the biggest obstacles for you when you are providing care? Because I have to imagine there are certain perceptions of Israel as a country when you're taking people from Syria who might have certain views of Israel. Do you face any challenges in providing care?
There are challenges which are medical challenges, and there are challenges which are interpersonal. So the interpersonal, let's say, challenges, these are people that are coming to a country which they perceived for years as an enemy country. So they're frightened. They don't know what to expect. So we're in the north part of Israel, we're a population which is pretty mixed. It's like half minority and half Jewish majority. So many of our staff is Arab-speaking. And so the first thing we make an effort to do is that an Arab social worker does intake for them. The staffing that works with them, like the nurses, that we always have Arab-speaking nurses. And that puts them at ease that the first thing they see is someone speaking in their tongue. We bring them toys. We bring them medical clowns. We do things that try to put them at ease so that they don't feel threatened. And you really do see the dynamics that develop our interpersonal relationships. Like they do understand by the end that we really are there to help them, that's our goal. Now, there are medical challenges, which are they're going back to a war-torn country with no medication. So we give them a few months' supply of medication, which is crucial for them. Now, they're also going back to an enemy enemy. I put in, you know, this is radio, but I have quotation marks because people are people, of course. They go back to a country which sees us as their enemy, and we don't know what their future holds. So all their medication, all the medical, we give them medical records. It's all done. Not in English. It's not done in Hebrew. We remove all traces of Hebrew writing so that if they're going to be in a place that's hostile towards us, we hope they won't be in any kind of imminent danger. There's no trace of the treatment that we gave them. The clothes we bring them, the toys we give them, we cut out all Hebrew writing, all labels in Hebrew. I mean, these are big challenges. Another challenge is knowing that they can come back for an operation. You know, we're sending them back, and we want to call them back. So, you know, these are challenges. A lot of the challenges, the Israeli Defense Force works it out somehow.
So did the Israeli Defense Force reach out to you to start the program? Is that how you started it?
The program is the IDF, Israeli military program. He asked us, all the hospitals in the north of Israel, the three hospitals, to join to this important and humanitarian project and to help the Syrian children. And of course, we did it with a lot of love and voluntarily, and it make us very satisfied for this project.
How long has the program been going on now? Because I know the Syrian war has been ongoing for quite some time.
Well, the civil war in Syria started in 2011. For the last 5 years, we are treating injured Syrians, civilians, injured that crossed the border, asking our help, and the military, Israeli military, bring them to the hospitals in the north of Israel. The last 3 years, we began this project helping is Syrian children in sort of elective treatment by examining them and operate them if they're needed.
There's, of course, been a lot of conflict right now in Israel. Are you afraid that the kind of internal conflicts that are going on might impact your ability to do your work?
We work with conflicts always. We're doctors. We give medical care, and that's our focus, and we do it in all sorts of conditions. We will continue to do our work. We'll continue to treat people as people. This program crosses borders on an interpersonal level, and I think it makes us feel really good, and it's very important to us. It's one of our values as Israelis.
The only concern is that maybe the situation will stop the project from the Syrian side. We would like it to continue, and we will do our best as long as the Syrian children will seek for our help.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. It was a pleasure speaking with all of you.
Thank you.
Dr. Betsheva Sadach is the deputy chief of the emergency department at Baruch Padeh Medical Center in Perea, and Dr. Erez On is the director general of the hospital. Their trip to Milwaukee was organized by the Israel Center of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation and Partnership Together. They spoke with Joy Powers. Lake Effect's Bonnie North is with us in the studio right now, and that interview is a good example of just the wide range of interviews you hear each and every day on Lake Effect, from interviews that give you new perspectives on international situations to interviews that really take you behind the scenes at local organizations. There are all kinds of segments that make up a typical day on Lake Effect, and what's interesting about this is it's entirely made possible by contributing members like you, who play a role in our spring membership drive by calling 414-227-3210 or by visiting wuwm.com/give. And taking advantage of this is day two of our spring membership drive.
It is indeed, and we still have that t-shirt available for a $120 donation or a $10 a month or more donation. It is a gray t-shirt. It's a poly ring spun cotton and rayon tri-blend. It's an easygoing look and easy care, I might add. For very easygoing people. And it's available in men's and women's sizes, all the way from extra small to extra, extra large. Please make sure that you do click on the open button and select your size and confirm your request by hitting the submit button if you decide you want a t-shirt, because otherwise you won't get it, even though you think you have said so. It's one of those little technological gremlins. But the important thing is that you make the call, 414-227-3210, wuwm.com/give, to support the kind of programming that you hear on Lake Effect every day. I mean, I love the fact that we can go all the way from the Israeli border to the backyards of the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center.
Exactly. It's really we can cover a lot of ground in about an hour's time. I should also mention, by the way, today only when you make a contribution at the $10 or more level. That's just $10, not $10 a month, not $10 a year. When you donate $10 or more, you'll receive a certificate for $5 off your next visit to Cafe Corazon.
Which is wonderful, I have to say.
And I've never been, but this is a good excuse.
Tacos.
Two locations, Bayview and River West, and it's open for lunch, dinner, brunch. And again, when you make a contribution today only of $10 or more, you'll receive that $5 gift certificate to Cafe Corazon, only by calling 414-227-3210 or visiting us at wuwm.com.
We'll take a short break, and then, as we mentioned, we're going to explore the opportunities created by some innovative partnerships at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. That comes your way when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It takes a lot of time and money to restore and maintain a natural area, a place where ecosystems can flourish and in which humans can find refuge.
About 10 miles north of downtown Milwaukee, the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center is one such place. The 40-year-old organization manages 85 acres of habitat along Lake Michigan's shore.
But the work comes with other challenges besides time and money. For example, Schlitz Audubon recently learned it's been hit hit by emerald ash borer. The invasive beetle could decimate 35% of the nature preserve's canopy.
But the center has also benefited from partners along the way who take on everything from the invasive beetles to finding the area's hidden history. Lake Effect's Susan Benz picks up the story by introducing us to one such partner, David Pacifico of Cardinal Stritch University.
So as we take a walk up this way, you can do what any archaeologist would do.
It's immediately clear. If you hang out with David Pacifico, you need to listen and think fast. Early this spring, more than 50 people were trying to do just that as Pacifico walked along Schlitz Audubon Nature Center's terrace. It's about 12 acres that stretches below the center's main building. Pacifico coordinates research and policy in Cardinal Stritch's School of Continuing and Online Learning. He also holds a PhD in anthropology. Digging into how people from long ago lived their lives is his passion. He's curious about what families left behind on this landscape before the Nature Center came to life. Pacifico encourages the group to think like an anthropologist.
Kind of scan the surface to see if there's any kind of remains, interesting kind of anomalies in the surface.
He's delving back pre-1885. That's when three brothers of the Eline family, owners of the Schlitz Brewing Company, acquired the property and deeded it to the brewery. Its horses used to recuperate here from long hours delivering heavy beer kegs by carriage. Even before he moved from Chicago to Milwaukee a couple of years ago, Pacifico and his family had visited Schlitz Audubon and questions started percolating. What about Dutch and German immigrants who farmed here before the Elines and Schlitz came on the scene?
Either a depression from a basement or a lump from a foundation. And if something looks super duper compelling.
Pacifico is not the first to contemplate early life here. He reads from a 1972 Milwaukee County Historical Society publication.
So he says the Garrett Walters farm of 30 acres was along the lakeshore east of the Schmaltz farm. So the Schmaltz farm was on the bluff, where here we are east of it. Walters bought this farm on December 20th, 1848, and Mr. Walters had the contract to build the first Fox Point Public School on Fox Lane in the southwest corner of what is now Doctor's Park, and that's actually shown on the historical map.
He's hoping others will catch the bug and go looking for histories like these, about often forgotten pockets of people throughout the region, starting at Schlitz Audubon. His online interactive portal, called the Milwaukee Community Archaeological Project, allows amateur archaeologists to add or compare their findings.
One of the things that the online research portal allows for is filling in of this information, which of course connects this area, much like the ecological mission of Schlitz Audubon Nature Center collects the ecological things that we can see and experience here with the broader environment. Well, the historical and social elements of this property, of course, are also connected to other places.
Anyone can join the project, but it's set up like an online course, so people need to sign on by getting in touch with Pacifico. He hopes to attract both people who like nothing more than to jump on their laptops to those who prefer tramping around outdoors. Pacifico is crossing his fingers that a grant he applied for will pay for a high-resolution GPS system. The tool would, among other things, allow him to spatially analyze what lies beneath the ground. And boy, would people get excited about those images, Pacifico says. On that sunny March day, he pushed on, hoping to discover footings of a barn built by another family, the Swarts. The barn was mentioned in the Historical Society document Pacifico referenced earlier.
There's a suggestion that to the due west, there was a footing of the barn. I kind of want to poke over there and take a look. Mark, is that acceptable?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Mark White is Schlitz Audubon's Director of Conservation. We'll hear from him shortly. Pacifico's makeshift archaeological team scatters, heads bent to ground strewn with dried leaves and brush. In a matter of minutes, someone spots the foundation. Pacifico is euphoric.
Oh, that is really cool.
He immediately ponders how many cows resided in the barn and whether their owners left relics of their lives behind.
Well, that's fantastic. I don't know, like, what could be more exciting.
A quizzical participant suggests finding the barn's foundation might be a setup.
It wasn't. Mark, anything you want to add?
Well, I think we just made your day.
Thank you very much.
That's Schlitz Audubon's Mark White again. The director of conservation is delighted to see so many people on the grounds.
Well, this is also another thing about this partnership is people are interested in these aspects of the nature center.
So it's broadening your circle.
Yeah.
Finally, the question you've been waiting to ask, will Pacifico be allowed to dig in search of human artifacts?
Yeah. David has talked about like ground probing. Radar and So there's different approaches, you know, that we want to explore before we start digging holes, but then some type of restoration plan for the site after we get done.
As it turns out, the potential archaeological dig sites are low in what Mark White calls native vegetation quality.
Yeah, I don't think there's any real difficulty in making sure that we heal that land and make it better after we're done. We just have to then integrate that into our overall conservation plan.
Are we ready, guys?
Yeah.
So let's start walking. Let's go walk the site.
A few weeks later, White is surrounded by a cluster of a different sort, arborists. They were volunteers for a day through the Wisconsin Arborists Association, another partnership forged with the Nature Center. The arborists were setting out to remove as many ash trees as they could that morning and afternoon. Invasive beetles called emerald ash borers are bringing down trees in more than 24 states, including Wisconsin's southern half. White says his small team has been able to tend to some of the center's most potentially hazardous areas, including where little kids enrolled in Schlitz Audubon's preschool spend time. The goal is to take out the dying trees before they become a safety hazard. But White's having trouble keeping up.
We've had two mild winters in a row, and it's just, they're just eating all the time. The vast majority of the work, you know, that we do for emerald ash borer is done in winter, you know, when the ground is frozen, so we can drop trees and go in there with that type of equipment and move logs around and pull brush out and chip the brush.
One volunteer team took on the tricky task of tending to trees on the steep bluff that leads to Lake Michigan. The slope is already prone to erosion. Another vulnerable old ash with wide-reaching branches is not only inconveniently positioned with a building just to its north.
But we also have a sugar maple growing up right through this ash tree. Just beautiful, yeah. And it's so, you know, with the loss of the ash, really the maple and that black cherry right there are going to start taking over that spot. But only if we can take the tree down without crushing or damaging.
White watches the tree specialist carefully trim back the old ash and then requests an additional feature, hoping owls will hang out where the majestic trunk once stood.
But we're going to be mounting an owl nest at the top of that. Okay,
so we can take the whole top down to like where that Y is essentially?
Yeah, maybe just below that Y.
White says Schlitz Audubon hopes to treat some of its still unaffected ash trees, especially those sprinkled throughout the delicate bluff area.
But we haven't been able to find funding for it.
Then last spring, another wrinkle appeared in the form of an endangered bumblebee.
We found rusty patch bumblebee on site, which is a federally endangered bumblebee. So that means we can't use most of the insecticides. All we could possibly use is triage, you know, to do these. But right now we just haven't been able to get the money, you know, and kind of the long-term support that I think we need to start treating, you know, a large number of ash and try to preserve them.
During the course of the day, fortified by donuts and pizza, the arborist tended to nearly 80 ash trees, including a bunch along Schlitz Audubon's popular hiking trails. But White says there's still much more to be done.
You know, once you finish that, I got about 100 more like that.
For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Susan Bentz is WUWM's environmental reporter. You can see pictures from her reporting trip at WUWM.com. And Susan's reporting trip and the trips that we all take are made possible because a number of people, our many members, in fact, have stepped up to the plate and helped us reach our goals over the course of time during our membership drives, including the one we're in now. This is day two of our spring membership drive. We're seeking 11 new or renewing members during this hour of Lake Effect, and you can play a role in keeping Susan out on her reporting trips and all of us doing the things that we do each and every day by calling 414-227-3210 or visiting us at wuwm.com/give. You know, you can take advantage of this unique opportunity to wear your love of public radio proudly.
Yes, you can, because during this drive only, we have a T-shirt available that is gray, quite nice. It's kind of like that dark charcoal gray. It's very classy. It's got golden headphones, and it says, "I'm well informed." WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR, which, of course, is the station you listen to because you are listening to us right now, and we thank you for it. That is available for a $10 a month or or more donation, or a single time $120 donation or more. And you can choose your size from women's extra small to men's extra, extra large. Just go ahead and make that choice when you make your contribution at WUWM.com or tell the very friendly person at the other end of the phone at 414-227-3210 that you would like to claim a T-shirt.
We mentioned the idea of donating $10 a month and you become a sustaining member. It's a great chance to keep your gift to public radio, keeping us healthy on into the future. We really appreciate our many sustaining members. If you're interested in becoming a sustaining member, I think you can do it at just about any level, starting at $5 a month. So when you make that call to 414-227-3210 or visiting WUWM.com, and today only, when you donate $10 or more, you'll receive a certificate for $5 off your next visit to one of Cafe Corazon's two locations in Bayview and River West.
Yum. I think it's time for lunch, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think so. But before that, we're going to take another break and then focus on the work of one of the community organizations doing a lot of great work here in town. Express Yourself Milwaukee is getting ready for their big yearly performance, and we'll learn more about it next. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Art brings joy. That's the vision of those who work with Express Yourself Milwaukee. The local nonprofit places artists with groups of at-risk and low-income kids, and the goal is for the young people to express themselves creatively and discover inner strength and connection with others.
The artists work with the youth in many environments, in schools, after-school programs, detention centers, youth prisons, and at the Express Yourself studio. But the program has a year-round singular focus on the arts.
And that is the final performance this Thursday evening at the Miller High Life Theater. This year's theme is Move It, and it will feature 150 young performers accompanied on stage by 30 adult artists and musicians.
Express Yourself Milwaukee founder and executive director Lori Vance sat down with WUWM's Mayan Silver to discuss how the organization came to be.
What I was aware of with my kids growing up in MPS is that there was a real discrepancy in kids that had access to mental health services, and I'm a therapist, and I was seeing kids outpatient and realizing that there's a lot of kids in Milwaukee that didn't have access, or that mental health services are not really in the traditional way helpful when you go back into a chaotic environment. And that kind of combined with my concerns about gun violence in our city. And when September 11th happened, I really felt like there are kids in our city that are growing up in war zone where gunfire is a daily occurrence, where their families are in high risk of violence. And I just felt like I needed to do something. And I was aware of this program in Boston, Express Yourself, and really liked the model. I'm an art therapist and liked the idea of product and process. As a therapist, we stay in a lot of process work with people, which is wonderful. The product is their experience and their expression. But when we work together to create something like the final show that's coming up, that a lot of the barriers that keep us separate break down, because we have to get this done. There's an audience that's showing up, and we need it to be strong and looking good. And so I really like the model. I like the idea of collaboration. I think a lot of us working together, it's easier. It's a lovely word, and it's an easier said than done. And the program is a ongoing year-long experiment in how do we as adults work together to support kids in our community to be able to express themselves. So it was a kind of a combination of things that brought it to be.
And can you run me quickly through the stats of like what the school, like, you know, who's all involved?
Yeah. So we work with about 1,200 kids every year, and we have a therapeutic level and corrections services. So we go into the detention center and the corrections Milwaukee County Accountability Program. Then we have our after-school programming, which is the stuff that you've been watching and observing. And then we have our in-school program. So we have some teams that go into schools. And then we also have our studio here is also available for individual referrals and for kids that have specific mental health needs. And we're an art therapy based opportunity for kids.
What's the connection between art and mental health?
Well, so, you know, traditional talk therapy is not always the best route to healing. And one of the things that I think, you know, throughout time that art has been a resource for us to access and to change our neural pathways. So there's been a lot of brain research that talks about the power of rhythmic movement, rhythmic drumming, painting and drawing, and they just allow us access to broader resources, and especially with kids and the inner kid in each of us, which is often where our early wounds come from. It's more accessible. It's a visceral experience that helps us to know that we can be stronger. We can come from our resilient selves, and that we can, when we're making art, we can figure it out. You know, we can, when we're trying to sing together, we can, you know, finding a melody together can help us join with our friends or our people that we're with, and dancing together. There's an exhilaration in just moving together or allowing space for people to have a solo and then coming back together to our groups is just a natural way that humans heal.
What's the sort of response that you get from the community?
So our show, I mean, we have an audience of about, last year I think there were over 1,000 people in the theater. It's a big theater. We can fill it. So our annual show is really a great way for people to come together. Milwaukee has a lot of things going on, and there's a lot of opportunity for people to offer positive support in the community, and I feel like Express Yourself just consistently shows up telling people that we believe in you and we believe we can work together. And so people are very responsive and very positive. You know, we have groups going on in the detention center and MCAP, and, you know, guards whose job it is to hold the line are also smiling and beating along with the drum beat and in there helping us finish set pieces. And, you know, art is a way that we can join with each other, which I think is really important.
It's amazing what a little humanity will do to people.
Yes, it really is. Yeah, and even in, you know, really, you know, I've been thinking a lot about how hard it is for us to come together. Lives are so complicated. We have so many things going on. And yet if we mark, you know, we show up every week. One of the tenets of Express Yourself model is consistency, that we're going to show up and we have this team so that even when one adult in the team can't come for whatever reason, there's still this structure that is going to come. And the sites that we visit, the kids in the groups, they know. When we go up to Lincoln Hills, we've worked with some of those kids in the detention center, and then they are up at Lincoln Hills and they see us and they light up because they know, oh, Afunga Alafia, are we gonna dance? Are we gonna paint? You know, they know the artists, and it does really bring us together.
And that consistency, you know, probably some of the kids haven't had that in their lives and they've been maybe abandoned in various ways. And so it's probably, you know, something to rely on.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things, we're a wraparound provider, and one of the things that I love about wraparound is really the belief that parents want to do the best that they can for kids, for their kids, and that there are just reasons that they are not able to. And so what I love about Express Yourself is that we show up and support the strength of families, the strength of kids, and the strength of parents to be able to support their kids. I mean, there's complications in people's lives, and often we look for what's not working for the, I look at those, some of the kind of stereotypes about kids, you know, not having parents in their lives. And I think that's not true. Parents are in their lives to the capacity that they can be, and that there are systemic reasons in our community that kids don't have the support that they need to be successful and to be kids, to play and to smile and to have ease with each other. There's so many complications. And so I just feel like the more we can, as adults, show up and believe in people and believe in families and believe in schools and believe in, you know, even in the corrections, you know, when you think about a guard whose job it is to keep, you know, keep the order. That's a hard job. I couldn't do it. So how do we uplift each other is really what I think we're trying to do here.
Do you ever feel like it's a struggle to find that empathy, or does it always come like very fluidly?
I want to say I don't, it's not hard to do that, but I know that there are places when I'm stressed, I have to really get myself grounded. I mean, what I talk about, all of our teams, the adults that show up for kids, you know, we circle up before we go into a group so that, because we're coming from all these different places with all these different things on our minds, how do we get present with the kids that we're going to be working with? And we walk into environments where there's stuff going on and we have to kind of jump in, make the group happen pretty quickly. And so, yes, it's very easy to access it, and it's hard because it really requires me to have discipline and focus and trust. And, you know, there's a lot of, running a nonprofit is not an easy thing. This, you know, there's lots of people doing really good work in the community, and, you know, big part of my job is to convince people that this is where they need to put their support and engagement. And, you know, we have a lot of distractions, and so in that way it's hard. But when I look into people's eyes, or if I go in with expecting the best of myself and of the people I'm working with, it isn't hard. So it's both, I guess, is what I'm saying.
What about people that don't understand art, the power of art, that people are like, well, it's just art, or like you were saying in the beginning, or like Martina was saying, you know, people sometimes write off art as something that's not necessary or something that's not helpful. What do you say to that?
Well, I really believe that art is important and essential in our for our humanity, and that beauty and joy and celebration, which are all part of art. And I also believe that art is a way for us to have difficult conversations. You know, Express Yourself early in our years, gun violence in the city was an issue that we really addressed because one of our kids was killed in the middle of a school year. I mean, it's a horrible, how do we talk about this in a way that that makes, brings hope and possibility? And to me, making art, like, I don't have an answer, but if we make something together, I believe that we can find the answers together. And, you know, so the Remembrance Tree was a piece of a project that we worked on that really addressed that year after year after year, because the loss of lives is really tragic in our community, and loss of children's lives. I mean, and just making art together, we start to break down the barriers that make it hard to talk about it and help us work together on it. I think now our community is in, you know, we're trying to find a way to work together. And if we can step in and be open to each other, I think art allows us that, because if I don't know how to dance, I can learn from you. And if you don't know how to paint, I can paint with you and share what I know. So, you know, there's a lot of research too, and I'm not a scientist in that way, but there is a lot of research that's showing that actual brainwaves are changed. You know, kids playing music do better in math, you know, and the repetitive movement, repetitive drumming, that really starts to change the neural pathways. So I'm not one that feels like I have to prove that. I just believe it and keep finding people that can join me in that, I guess.
Lori Vance is founder and executive director of Express Yourself Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. The group's culminating performance for the year is tomorrow evening at the Miller High Life Theater. And Mitch Tyke, this is not the culminating performance of our year, but it is our spring membership drive, and we're in day two.
We are, and we're on our way up to a goal of 11 new or renewing members during this hour of Lake Effect. You can get us there by calling 414-227-3210. or by visiting us at wuwm.com/give. Take advantage of one, or I guess maybe it becomes both, special offers we have for today.
That's right. We have ongoing throughout the entire drive. If you can make a donation of $120 or a continuing donation of $10 a month or more, you will get a WUWM t-shirt, which basically says, I am well informed. Because you listen to WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
You're well informed and well dressed.
And well dressed. It's a wonderful combination. The other thing that's ongoing today only, though, and that is for a donation of $10. That's just $10, not $10 a month, $10 a year. You will get a certificate from Cafe Corazon that takes $5 off your next visit. And if you've never been to Cafe Corazon, Mitch Tyke, you really should go because it is quite delicious.
I resemble that remark.
You do.
So that's today only. When you donate $10 or more, you receive that $5 certificate for Cafe Corazon. One more break and then a chat with author Patricia Skalka about the latest in her series of mysteries set in Door County. This is Lake Effect on listener-supported WUWM, Milwaukee. Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Door County is a popular destination for both Wisconsin natives and tourists from other states. Its varying natural landscapes, state parks, and towns draw thousands to the peninsula and to the ferries that take them to Washington Island.
For author Patricia Skalka, who splits her time between Chicago and a family cottage in Door County, the peninsula is the perfect setting not just for a getaway, but murders.
Her latest book, Death Rides the Ferry, is the fourth installment in her Dave Kubiak Door County mystery series, and it follows Sheriff Kubiak as he tries to make sense of a troubling series of events occurring on Washington Island during an early music festival.
Before we get too deep in the mystery, Skalka joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone to talk about that latest book. She begins by explaining who her protagonist is and why he has stuck with her for so long.
Dave's an interesting guy. He started off as the broken man. I needed that kind of protagonist. I needed someone from outside of the Door County Peninsula community to be able to solve the crimes, because they all the source of what happened in the first book all went back in time. So I needed someone who was completely unfamiliar with people, didn't know their histories, the grudges, the wrongs that had occurred decades prior that would be the seeds for what was happening now. So he was just kind of bubbling up in my head as I was working out the rest of the story. I made him come from Chicago, which seemed logical. He was a former cop. I needed him to have the ability, the skills to solve a homicide, because he'd been a homicide detective. And I realized when I wrote the first book, I intended it to be what's called a standalone, just one and done. But by the time I finished it, I realized I wanted to do a series. The other ideas had been kind of coming up to me and presenting themselves to me. And so I knew that I couldn't leave Dave in this place where he started out, and that I wanted him to kind of get better and to heal as a person and to kind of learn to forgive himself, because he's burdened with grief and guilt at the beginning. The only way I could figure out to do that was to move him through time. So the stories progress through time. He's 42 in the first one, and then he's 44 in Death of Gill's Rock. In the third book, Death in Cold Water, he is 46. And in Death Rides the Ferry, he's looking at 50. So I see the series, the overall arc of the series is his journey of personal redemption.
Door County is a very different picture from Chicago, where Kubiak came from. But Door County also has a rich tradition of storytelling, especially oral storytelling. So did that play any part to inspire the series or even your writing?
Well, I'm always interested in the history of the location, and Door County is just marvelous in terms of the richness of its history. But what really inspired the initial story and the series, as it turned out, was the setting of Door County itself. It was the notion of this place with this pristine surface and sinister forces at work beneath. And that came about from sitting on the beach on a beautiful sunny day and then sitting in the same spot on a cloudy, dark night and sort of thinking about the difference between day and night and light and dark and good and evil. And that gave birth to the whole idea for the story, for the series.
Yeah, Door County can definitely be a beautiful and at the same time treacherous landscape.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a history of a lot of tragedy up here, you know, things that, you know, we think of it now as this kind of bucolic place of, you know, a lot of artists and a lot of tourists, and things seem to be all kind of moving in a very positive direction. But in the early residents and settlers, they battled nature and they battled illness, and, you know, they didn't have a very easy time of it.
Right. With the title, Death Rides the ferry is perhaps a quintessential experience for some people when they make a trek up to Door County between the mainland peninsula and Washington Island. So was it that aspect of the ferry playing a part in Door County culture that made it your focal point?
You know, that's a great question, because it's the book that almost didn't get written. I mean, I've been coming up here for decades. I've ridden that ferry a zillion times, and it had never occurred to me to use the ferry in one of the books. Now, you talk about staring at the obvious and not seeing it. And then several years ago, I was on the ferry on a beautiful day with my older daughter, Julia. And, you know, I'm kind of staring off into the blue sky. And she looked at me and she said, "Mom, you know, what about a death on the ferry?" And it was just like so obvious. I looked at her, I thought, "Oh, my God, what a great idea." Yes, of course. But then I had to, you know, figure out all of the rest of the pieces, because there is a lot that goes into putting a mystery together. So it's like, well, what's going on? Is there something going on Washington Island? And if so, what? That's attracting people. Why is this person who dies on the ferry? Who kills them? What's the motive? So there was a lot to go from there. But it's like she handed me this gift, and it became the fourth book.
On that note, I was curious how you stage a mystery, because this one also involves a 40-year-old mystery, a 40-year-old case that kind of is revived, something that maybe may not be a part of most mystery novels or any novels is your early music history and the setting here and this old instrument called the viol. So can you explain, you know, the story at the heart of this mystery and how you decided to layer it up? Was it based off any real events or festivals that were on Washington Island?
No, it was not, but it did come from a conversation I had with a friend of mine many years ago. She's a classical musician. She plays the violin and the viola, and she told me about viola da gamba, which I had never even heard of. It's, you know, kind of an esoteric, old form of music, and the instruments had kind of fallen out of favor. You know, they were replaced by the violin, which is a stronger sound. And so the viola da gamba just fell by the wayside, more or less. There were always people who stayed, you know, loyal to it. And I was thinking, you know, as I was trying to piece together the story for the book, the plot line, I thought, well, if I want to have something happen on Washington Island, why not a music festival? And then I thought, well, why not something a little bit different? And that's when this old memory came back to me of the viola da gamba. Because when my friend had told me about it, I always thought, I'm going to file that away and use it sometime. But I never had a reason to or a means of using it. And that's why the festival is what it is. I thought, let's do something different. And of course, everything about the old instrument is completely fabricated. But that's one of the beauties of writing fiction. You can combine actual fact, and then you have literary license to make other things up.
Exactly. And it's not too far off that Washington Island may have sort of an event like this. You know, the Door County arts community is so prevalent out there.
Right. Yeah. It to me, it was a natural fit. And in each of my books, I try to link the crime that's occurring in the present that Kubiak has to solve with something that happened in the past. So, again, it was very it just lent itself to that theme, to have had a previous festival where something very tragic had happened, and then link it to the current events.
You used to write nonfiction for Reader's Digest for about 20 years, and now obviously you're switching to fiction. But what did writing in those formats teach you that translated into your mystery writing, you know, when it comes to human nature or even being better well prepared to research a project?
Well, I did learn how to research many, many different topics because I would do, you know, medical stories about medical developments and new technologies, and I would have to go and, you know, study them and learn about them so I could ask them reasonably intelligent questions. And then all stories for the Digest revolved around people. So there was the element of human interest. And in interviewing people, you really learn to kind of try to put yourself in their place. And sometimes people are very animated and very capable of talking through a situation. And other times they really, you know, they have all of the memory inside of what happened, but they can't necessarily articulate it. So you kind of have to say, well, was it like this? And was it like that? Or would you have said this at the time? And doing that for years with, you know, sitting in people's living rooms, talking to them face-to-face or at their kitchen table really helps in writing dialogue. Because I can imagine how, you know, a different character would talk and try to imagine how they would think through a situation. So in many ways it was helpful. And just writing and working with words, learning to deal with editors, learning to meet deadlines, all of those elements come into play in writing fiction.
I'm curious, when are you satisfied with an ending for your mysteries?
Wow, that's a tough question to answer because it's, obviously, the mystery has to be solved. And then it's the concept of going full circle. At the beginning of the story, you present the reader with a problem, a challenge, a situation, and part of it is the mystery, what's happened. And then part of it also is maybe what's going on in someone's life and how they're going to resolve that particular issue. And so the story is finished when I've come full circle and I've resolved the mystery and I've showed the reader that the protagonist in this case, or maybe other characters also, have made progress in facing or resolving the particular situation that they were dealing with either at the beginning or somewhere along the line of the story. It has to have a sense of completeness. And when I feel like it has a sense of completeness, that's when I'm done.
Patricia Skalka is the author of Death Rides the Ferry. It's the latest installment in her Dave Kubiak Door County Mystery Series. She'll be in Milwaukee at Boswell Books to talk about her book tomorrow evening at 7. There is more information about the book and the event at WUWM.com. And Mitch Teich, of course, that is where you can go to make a contribution in this day 2 of our spring membership drive.
Get us to our hourly goal of 11 new or renewing members during this hour of Lake Effect by visiting us at WUWM.com or calling 414-227-3210. It's day 2 of the membership drive. We have a number of ways of thanking you for your support of Lake Effect and all the programs you depend on, whether it's Fresh Air coming your way next or the latest news from the BBC and a variety of partners, which comes your way just a little bit later on WUWM. Again, 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com.
Claim your T-shirt, available for that $120 donation or a $10 a month or more donation. And also today only, the $5 certificate from Cafe Corazon, as long as you donate $10. That's all you need to donate if you want to claim that. Obviously, anything that fits into your budget is more than welcome. We thank you for every single penny that comes in. We couldn't do it without you. 414-227-3210, WUWM.com/give.
That is all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I am Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It is right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.